Hello and welcome to this special collaborative podcast episode between Media Voices and Journalism.co.uk, two trusted publishers giving you expert views and news from around the media industry. I'm Jacob Granger from Journalism.co.uk.
And I'm Esther Thorpe, I'm one third of the Media Voices team. The Media Voices you know and love are going through a few changes over the next few months. I think we'll chat about that in a little bit. But don't worry, our publisher podcast and newsletter awards and summit, they're not going anywhere. If this is the first you've heard of them, we've just held a full day dedicated to publisher podcasts and newsletters, basically from how initial tests in paid podcasts are going right through to commercial strategies for niche newsletters. And this episode, we are going to dip into some of the key themes and talking points. It was a very full day. Jacob, you were there. How did you find it? Because I just sat on the door the whole day.
Yeah, no, it was a great event. I went around the room with Peter and a mic. I listened in on many of the talks, and there were a couple of really striking themes for me. I think the first one is that for independent and specialist titles, podcasts and newsletters are a powerful tool to command relationships with those very specific audiences. And that quality over quantity approach opens up so many monetization opportunities. It's often the other way around for larger publishers who look to these products to grow their portfolio and appeal overseas. There's a great interview coming up with The Scotsman about its food and drink podcast, tapping in to tourist intrigue from the US.
I'm going to butcher this with the US pronunciation now, but riches in niches.
It doesn't rhyme in English, does it? In the British accent, no.
Riches in niches for those in the UK. Riches. So there's this whole sort of approach of podcasting and newsletters that binds them together. There's plenty more similarities and there's some core differences as well. I think we'll learn about that coming up. I think one thing for me when I was putting the agenda together is that it was striking how, like, email's been around for a long time, right? It's one of the oldest sort of internet communication formats. And it's amazing how many publishers have only sort of recently turned that lens on as a bit of an opportunity. You know, podcasting again has been around for quite a long time and we've seen the huge wave of that rise. So yeah, I'm actually quite excited to share some of what we put together at the summit.
Yeah, it's been a real resurgence and really looking forward to dipping into this one. So I think before we get into the meat of the podcast and newsletter summit, let's talk about the news of the week with you, Esther, and the Media Voices team. There's a fair few, you know, chopping and changing happening in the immediate future. What's changing and why?
So the TLDR version is that basically we are just narrowing our focus on podcasts, newsletters, and other publisher products. At Media Voices, you know, we've been going for, we're approaching our eighth birthday now. And we always tried to cover as much as we possibly can. And it just got to the stage we kind of realised we'd fallen into like the mushy middle of media coverage where we're trying to cover too much. You know, none of us are even remotely part-time on Media Voices, very much still evenings and whatever hours we can squeeze out. So we thought, well, let's keep the themes from the event going throughout the year. Let's serve the audiences that come to those a bit better without sort of trying to compete with B2B publishers with much bigger resources than us. And we're going to focus really closely on, honestly, probably a lot of our award entrants and winners. What are they doing really well? What have they learned? And we're going to really tie that into publisher products like apps, magazines, podcasts, newsletters. The big thing is that we're dropping our daily newsletter and we're going into a weekly kind of deep dive approach. So it's just generally sort of trying to work smarter, not harder, and not killing ourselves in the process. I mean, you know as well as anybody some of the challenges of being a small indie out there, right?
Yeah, I get it. But for the time being, we're still calling you guys Media Voices, right?
We are, yeah. Media Voices will be the bigger umbrella. We're just doing, it's going to be the publisher podcast and the publisher newsletter. And then we've got the publisher summits and awards sort of under this Media Voices umbrella.
Yeah, I get it. But I also don't get it because journalism.co.uk, I mean, yes, we're a very small team. Yes, we're independently owned, but we work full time. And so I can't imagine having to do this on a part-time basis, you know, evenings and juggling all the rest that life has to throw at us. I'm guessing that's part of the decision-making process here.
It is, and it's a blessing and a curse. You know, I can raise my kids during the day and still do what I love in the evenings, but it doesn't leave much wiggle room for illness, burnout, anything else. And yeah, I think we just need to like prioritize and look after ourselves a bit better as well. But
you're all still going to be juggling the same balls up in the air that you've got going on at the moment still.
Yeah, but I think publishing, so between the three of us, it'll work out just over once a month rather than once every 3 days. will make quite a big difference.
And you're still going to do those really fantastic media reports, right?
Provisionally, yes. Yes, watch that space. I don't think we'll be doing media moments because, again, that's too broad. But our plan, ideally, is to do some really big deep dives into those publisher products and really lean into that audience and serving that rather than trying to compete with everybody else.
No, I do get it. But, I mean, you've been wonderful in everything that you've put together over the last few years. I don't really know how you've done it, but talk to me about some of the triumphs, the breakthroughs that you've really had as a team and what we can continue to expect from you guys in the future.
Honestly, I think a triumph is still being here. 8 years is a lot longer than many outlets with 10 times as much funding and resources go. And I don't know if that's just the longer we go, the more dogged the determination to keep going is. But actually, I think one of the highlights for me was launching the Publisher Podcast Awards. We opened them in 2019 and just seeing the response for that and thinking, okay, we have actually hit a bit of a niche here and that there is a need here to kind of celebrate the work that publishers are doing in this space. Holding that event on March the 4th, 2020, saying to Chris and Peter, do you think anybody's going to skip it because of this COVID thing going around? Nah. And then emerging out the other side, that was sort of a virtual event the following year. And we're still here, we're still going. There's so much more we'd love to do if we had the resources, and that's also a future plans. But yeah, I think just still being here and people turning around and saying, oh, wow, we didn't realise that you do that much with that little time. We're producing the same amount that the three of us were employed at a full-time team of eight back at the media briefing. So that's part of the reason we need to cut it back a little bit. But I'm quite proud of the fact that we continue to do that.
As you should be. And I really do relate to this because, I mean, we are also going through a period where we're just trying to understand who our readers are and what they really want from us. I mean, like you, we're in this moment where we're thinking, there's so much that we could be doing in this very explosive, ever-changing space. But, our team is quite small and we just want to hone in on that. So we have been launching a reader survey. If you are a media professional, I would just love to put this little plug in just to say, look, you can take a moment, head over to journalism.co.uk. You'll see a little click to apply. And there is a wonderful book prize on offer for one lucky entrant. So we'd love to hear from you guys if you have sort of 10 minutes to do that for us.
It's a very good survey. We'll comment it. It's a very well-designed survey. You don't often get them, but they're very, very good.
It took a lot of iteration on my editor, Martzella's part. Full credit to her for that.
Okay. So that's all very well. But I suppose back to the summits, what did we learn about podcasts and newsletters from them? I know there were lots of the sessions. I didn't actually attend very many of them, but obviously put the agenda together. Jacob, I know you attended some of them and you chatted to various people throughout the day. I think we're going to draw out five lessons from this. Do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, I would love to. I mean, we were just speaking there about the reality for independent publishers, and there was one super inspiring talk on the day, which I think really will set the tone for the discussion. Black Ballad is an independent lifestyle publisher written by and for Black women. It's been going on for nearly a decade at this point. It's a proof of concept that bootstrapped organizations can make it if they remain focused on mission and audience, instead of getting distracted and just simply following the money. They've got a little under 1,500 paying members to date, which grants all sorts of early access and perks from events to partnerships. But more than anything, Black Ballad exists to serve a void that many Black women feel hasn't been properly addressed in the mainstream. So let's go to founder Toby Oradine for more on that.
People build connections with humans and not brands. That's just the honest truth. You know, Black women hadn't been served by the media at the time when Black Ballad was coming out. We were always a bit of an add-on, or, it was a very narrow view of what Black womanhood looked like. And being really honest, in terms of mainstream media, I'm not exactly the Black woman that was always featured. It was someone that didn't quite look like me, that looks more like a Beyonce sort of, or maybe mixed race. So you had a Black woman who was kind of like the everyday Black woman kind of experience, going through kind of their 20s and didn't have it all together. And I think it became very relatable for the majority of Black women that were reading this, in terms of, okay, there's a relatable Black woman here who's just kind of figuring it out. As my life has changed, I've allowed the audience to go on that life journey with me. You know, when I started Black Ballad, I wasn't married. I wasn't a mum. Now I'm married. I'm mum of two. I'm full time on Black Ballad. And I kind of feel like just going through all those sort of letting the audience in, not too much, but letting them into sort of those life sort of like moments that I was going through, I think it made people really trust the brand actually and trust where I was coming from. And also another thing, I explained a lot of my decisions actually through my newsletter. I explained the membership that we did. I explained a crowdfund that we were doing, a community crowdfund. I kind of reflected on some of the things that I'd maybe got wrong at times and from a business point of view. So it also allowed a level of transparency as well, which I think was super important. And I think that transparency has actually been how people have decided to probably pay for a membership. Because what we find is that people might be on the newsletter for a couple of months, and then there might be a certain newsletter that makes them be like, aha, I'm going to actually invest and pay my money to get like the whole offering of Black Ballad.
And I mean, that newsletter really is the driving force of Black Ballad. There's a Friday night edition for members that rounds up the key articles, new partnership offers, updates within the organisation. And then they've got the founder's letter, which is a weekly personal musing by Toby, where she says that no subject is off limits. It's what Black women need to hear this week or what she's personally feeling. There's really, really high engagement on that founder's letter, which makes potential partnerships here really valuable. But she needs to be incredibly choosy because her reputation is on the line.
So the newsletter was the first thing a brand actually paid to sponsor. South Bank actually paid us, or the first people to pay us to sponsor the newsletter. And we don't do display because we're a membership platform. The experience is really important. You can't really pay for like a site and then you have all these ads popping up and it's like, right, we're not going to do that. I remember South Bank got in touch several years ago and they had an exhibition around Black art and it was like, you have this channel, and we was like, okay, we could do a newsletter. And it kind of just started as like a mini ad, and then it was just like, click free to buy a ticket, and we saw people were actually buying these tickets, and then we started to be like, okay, we might have stumbled across something. So I would love to sit and say that I knew that the newsletter was going to be make money from the beginning. I didn't. It was kind of the results of the South Bank, and more people started paying us for like these mini ads. I would write my founder's letter on a Sunday, would have a mini 200 word ad about whatever the exhibition was. Yeah. It would be like my personal POV on how I found it and if people should go. So we started monetizing it through that. And then people started to be like, well, I've got this experience, this product, this service. What if we took over your whole letter? So what if your whole founder's letter was about this sort of like particular partnership, which became quite lucrative as long as I found that it was the right partnership. I don't just put anything in that newsletter. I should say that because it's so sacred. I turn down quite a bit if I don't think it's quite right from my personal point of view and for me. And what we began to see is that people were just plugging money into the newsletter. And I realized why it was working was because, again, it's that trust. It was like, well, if I'm trying it and I'm like endorsing it for Black women, then Black women were kind of ready to kind of give it a go. I think when we saw the newsletter work in terms of a bigger partnership that involved multiple parts of the business was actually when we worked with Maltesers. Maltesers wanted to kind of go into this field of caring about maternal mental health. And I was about to give birth to my second child. And I kind of wrote this newsletter on about letting go of this superwoman complex as a mum second time round. So this newsletter opened the partnership. We had then an editorial video that went alongside it and a photo essay. And the partnership just went nuts. People love the partnership. We got a lot of mums saying like, this is the sort of content that they want.
So there's an absolutely bonkers stat in this talk, which is that Black Ballad has a retention rate of 95%, meaning once people sign up for the membership, they very rarely leave. But just because people feel they have nowhere else to go and they have, you know, captured a very specific audience here, Toby feels strongly that she can't rest on her laurels. She has to work very hard to make sure that people are happy.
When we first started the membership, it was just about content. But now we offer like experiences. So like if you was a member, you got to have an exclusive screening at Channel 4 with like food and nibbles and drinks. And you got to kind of have a Q&A with Candice Carty-Williams and the cast of Queenie. Last year, we sent 25 Black women to Bristol on a coach to learn how to surf. We've actually just improved this membership in terms of listening to this audience. One of the things that our audience said to us is that Black women want joy. They want fun things to do. So part of the Garnier partnership is that we're having this night of skincare for Black women where you're going to get free products, you get to ask questions, and you get to have like these consultant sessions. We've actually been active in asking our audience, how do you want to see us improve this membership? And what came out of it was, we love the content, but we want more of a well-rounded lifestyle experience membership. So we've worked really hard to build that in to the offering. And it's taken a few years because you kind of need some brands to do it. But that's how we've gone about it in terms of asking and hopefully answering.
So I think the lesson so far is that quality matters more than quantity when you have a specialist audience. And that goes for the type of content that you produce as well as the volume of your membership or readership. And this holds true for another publication called Rebe Media, who are a decade-old indie title. And the difference is that they have five different trade or experience-specific podcasts, literally this huge range from the brewery industry to pregnancy. They've taken so many awards home from the Publisher Podcast Awards, I've actually lost count over the years. And genuinely, if you want a masterclass in turning perhaps not the most exciting of topics into a really engaging podcast, look up Engineering Matters, because it's absolutely superb.
Full disclosure, I should be very familiar with Engineering Matters. They beat us in the B2B podcast category many times over. So,
like 4 years. They beat everybody.
4 years running. And at that point, I was like, well, come on. So, no, full kudos to publisher John Young and the team. He told us in an interview that the demand for these specialist titles starts by looking at the state of the market. And that allows him to hone in on very specific commercial partners.
So each one of them actually has come from a slightly different journey. A lot of it is looking at the state of the market. So we launched Brewers Journal in about 10 years ago. And it was when the craft beer movement was started. It was kind of underway in the US, hadn't really got going in the UK to the same level just yet. But we look for industries where there are more potential customers than a sales guy can reasonably get round in a year or so. And then also check that they're underserved. So when brewing hit about 2,000 breweries, that one sales guy who's selling malt grain, he can't get around 2,000 breweries in a year. So now there's a market for him to buy advertising to try and get his message across. The audience defines itself really well. If you're listening to the Brewers Journal, you're going to be interested in brewing. If you're listening to Engineering Matters, like, you're going to be interested in engineering. It actually makes the sales side on these products much easier. Because we don't have to worry too much about having massive numbers. Brewers Journal gets probably about 2,000-3,000 listeners an episode, but when there's only 2,000 breweries in the country, you know, we could be looking at more than 100% of the potential market. Engineering Matters is a bit more of a problem. We do about 40,000 listens an episode, but there's like 5 million engineers, so we're a little bit of a drop. We've been talking today about doing partnerships. Working with the right partners, working with partners who have got good reach. Our own social media reach is tiny compared to the size of the partners we work with. They might have 500,000 on their LinkedIn channel. They make a post there. What they don't realize is that they're paying us to produce a partnered episode. They want to reach our audience. That partnership works two ways. They're going to put our material out to their audience, which is, you know, 10-20 times the size of our audience.
In starker terms, John says that audience growth really isn't a high priority. Instead of going for scale, he wants to make sure that he reaches the right audiences. By doing that, he can guarantee commercial partners get their messages landing in the right inboxes.
Most of the guys who have got a message, most of the companies who have got a message to get out, there's only a few people who need influencing for that to have a huge effect. This could be, they could be trying to influence a tender. A small tender for these guys is maybe 500,000. A big tender is, you know, multiple billions. So if we can get the message to the one person on that tender team, just to influence maybe how the tender document is written or how they do the weighting or what they think is important when they're reviewing those tenders, it doesn't matter if we have 40,000. It matters that, and we know who that person is. We will just send it to them directly, so we'll know that that one person that is important gets it. Growth on the audience side, it's not a priority. It's great to achieve. We do actively kind of look for opportunities to improve it, but actually our entire focus is quality.
And how do you guarantee that quality? It's in a more simple podcast format.
If you adopt a documentary style, then you can do the same as we all do when we're back in our feature writing days. You can sit there into the late hours of the night, crafting and reshaping until you've got it perfect. And then you sit down in the studio and you cut it all together and it sounds, you know, you can make something sound great. You're recording now, you know, I've made multiple mistakes. You can cut this together and it can sound like a really compelling piece, or you can make me sound like an idiot, whichever you choose. But the, that format, it's cheap, it's quick to put out, but you have to be really, really good in order to make that work.
In both cases, newsletters and podcasts are great ways to go direct to audiences, whether that's straight into their inbox or earbuds. And another similarity between the two mediums is that they're great for developing super fans, and both of these hold true for publishers of all sizes. But another striking comparison is that they're powerful niche offerings. We're seeing this with specialist and independent publishers, as well as the larger ones who are going deep into verticals or doing pop-up products around events like the coronation or the election. Now, Jacob, you spoke to the FT's head of newsletters, Sarah Ebner, about pivoting at speed to fill market gaps. So let's hear what she had to say.
I tend to look for gaps where I think there should be a newsletter. So we didn't have a US markets newsletter. Now we have Unhedged, the award-winning Unhedged. We didn't have a UK politics newsletter. We have the award-winning Inside Politics. The same with fashion. We didn't have a business of fashion newsletter. So I look for the gaps for where we can fill things in, because I don't want a reader ever to look at a sort of newsletter page and think, I don't know what to sign up for because there's too many things, or what's the difference between that and that and that. That's why on that page, if anyone looks, they've all got, you know, illustrations for each newsletter, and they've all got taglines that would explain to you, and sample links so you can find out what they are. So it does take, it has taken a long time to get to that many newsletters, but we can launch quite quickly if we need to. I launched One Must Read last year. I just really wanted to launch that to send people to one piece a day, and that's been very effective. We had a newsletter that when I arrived was called Brexit Briefing, and then I thought that was not a great name because I arrived in, you know, Brexit happened. So we changed it to Britain After Brexit, which we thought was pretty clear that we were talking about how is Britain's place in Europe. And then more recently, we thought, you know what, we think people think that's a defunct newsletter because it has Brexit in it. And we renamed it State of Britain, the State of Britain, which we thought was much better, much more now about the challenges that Britain's facing. And it, obviously, a lot of them are due to Brexit, but some of them are not. And fortuitously, the election was then called, and we looked as if we were completely on point to rename that, and it's very relevant. The content hasn't changed that much because Peter Foster, who writes it, writes about the challenges facing Britain, but it's a better title, and it, you know, if there is a Labour government, we might finesse the tagline, for example, again. But it was a case of looking at it and thinking, this is really good content that we know our readers like, but maybe the name is not attracting that many new people to sign up. The numbers were quite static, and since then we've had new sign-ups.
The FT has 50 newsletters at this point in time, and it allows them to experiment by deploying them as premium or standard newsletters, or even as newsletter courses. Newsletters are also a way to test the water with topics that might seem unfamiliar or niche at first.
I don't think people would have expected us to have a fashion newsletter, and that came from the fact that, you know, Lauren Imbick is a really good writer, our fashion editor, and was Fashion Writer of the Year, and I thought she should have a newsletter. But I don't think people would expect us to have that. At the FT, they expect us to have these, you know, economics and finance and, you know, asset management and all those kinds of things. We have a big B2B audience, so we should, I think it's really good to be offering them, for example, they work in the legal industry, newsletters that they might want, so they engage with their corporate subscription, because we want them to not just get that subscription and think, I'm not going to use it. We want them to think it's useful. And we know newsletters are really good for engaging our B2B audience. And we also just want, we want people to subscribe to the FT, so we want to offer them things that we think they might like. And we're not, funnily enough, I don't think our newsletter offering is that broad. We have some lifestyle newsletters, just mentioned one, but we also have Weekend. That's all the Weekend, and we know FT Weekend works really well, but we don't have, you know, a singular arts newsletter, a singular books and letter that other organisations would have. And we didn't have a central banking newsletter. That seems quite niche. For the FT, it seems quite obvious we should have a central bank newsletter, so we have one. So I wouldn't want to diversify out of things that I felt were relevant to the FT.
One last comparison for good measure between podcasts and newsletters is the big personality hosts and talent that draw in audiences. The FT is one of many publishers now allowing staff to lead newsletters.
I'm very pro the personality or the voice of the newsletter writer. I think that what I thought this anyway, but when we launched our reader survey and we could see the newsletters ranked and what newsletters were at the top, they were all the ones with strong personalities where you really knew the person who was writing it and you got a sense of who they were, what they liked, what their opinions were. You know, I mentioned some of them before, Unhedged, Inside Politics, Swamp Notes, our US politics newsletter. These are ones that people really, really like. I think Substack has accelerated that a bit because that sort of individual newsletter writer has become what people expect, but I think it really works for us as well, also because we have a lot of really good writers who have expertise, and the combination of the two is a great thing.
The daily news publication The Scotsman is another great example of a larger legacy title trying to broaden its international appeal through podcasting in particular. Its Scran podcast goes deep into the local Scottish food and drink scene. It was launched in 2019 as part of the Google-funded Laudable project to diversify its audience. What it's found is that this has sparked tourist appeal in the US market, and it's interesting to note that the Scran brand has since extended into newsletters and awards too. Now, Scran was a big winner at the Publisher Podcast Awards that night, having entered for many, many years without having taken home any prizes. This is a brand to pay particular attention to in terms of keeping going, listening to feedback, and evolving to become a podcast which can rise above some serious competition. Here's Rosalind Erskine, host of the Scran podcast, with more.
The food and drink scene in Glasgow has changed hugely since, I mean, I moved away and came back, so in 10 years. But Scotland as a whole, there's, you know, obviously whiskey, really good meats, but I think people in Scotland have evolved and are more interested in the provenance of food. But there's also a huge tourism in it, and The Scotsman has an American audience and overseas audience, so we're tapping into telling the stories of your local farmer or your local baker or, you know, a well-known whiskey distillery, but also for the local, you know, population of Scotland, but also tourists as well, people coming to visit. So it's a guide to Scottish food and drink, as well as where are we going to eat, where are we going to drink, what's interesting, what's new. And I think the podcast feeds into that as well.
So once again, we're seeing very targeted advertising in this podcast. You'll hear lots of food and drink brands in the ad breaks. So what you're getting is that recurring theme, a specific podcast and a specific commercial opportunity spitting out of it. That doesn't happen by accident. The Scran podcast has built its appeal by hitting the road to get very close to the food and drink scene.
It's important to us to go to places and meet people face to face. That was always the kind of point of Scran. If it hadn't been for COVID, we would have been doing that the whole time. We do things online when it's easier. We used to do things in the studio when it was easier, but I think it's just more natural and you can get a sense of the environment. You can record some music, some chat. I mean, in the uphill, yeah, we got the wee girl behind us singing the song, and that was really nice. So there's like a sense of place there as well. I think when you're in places like that, people are more forgiving if there's background noise or chat, because it's part of the ambience. Unless it's me recording, there's never any really annoying noises. So yeah, I think it's hard, but it's not impossible, and I think it adds to the experience.
And one happy bonus is that a lot of content can also be repackaged across the wider news group for extra bang for buck.
We don't, that I know of, touch wood, have any massive competitors. We've been pretty well established. We've got the support of the brand, the Scotsman brand behind us. And my many, many guises, I also write for the paper as well as the website. So there's a lot of opportunities to turn good lines, top lines from a podcast into an article, which can go out across the whole of the Scotsman and potentially the whole National World Group. So yeah, I think we've been going a while, but I feel like we're only just kind of getting into our stride.
I should say, they tempted me with a very, very nice sounding, very expensive whiskey in one of their episodes. It's dangerous. The last thing we wanted to discuss is the US appeal. It's probably the last major talking point, and it's quite significant. What we're hearing is that the US market is an early indication of trends to come. I think we've seen this across many other aspects of media. Ben Ewart, head of podcasts at Immediate Media, has a wide portfolio of magazines and podcast shows, and he says that US podcast listeners are really warming up to paying for them. That is an encouraging sign for the rest of the industry.
But we've actually seen much more engagement in a subs becoming popularised in the US in comparison to our UK listeners. And I think culturally they're just more akin to things like Patreon, to things like YouTube. I think it's probably an early indicator that as slightly more hesitant attitudes start to thaw, hopefully globally people will be more accepting of paid-for solutions. As things like Patreon or YouTube Premium become more and more popular globally and people are willing to support content creators and have that community feel, podcasts will just be a natural part of how that subscription feels to a user. And it is a psychological hurdle more than it is a financial hurdle. So yeah, I'm hoping that is the trend that covers across to the UK and then hopefully onward from there.
He is optimistic that the appetite for podcast subscriptions will grow, but publishers will need to invest to see the growth.
The worst thing you could do as a publisher is start to make users feel penalised for just trying to engage with your content. If you do 5 episodes a week, I've seen examples of other publishers that go, right, well, we'll go to 4 free episodes a week and 1 premium. Well, now you've just taken an episode away from someone who, that's their daily listening habit. They now don't have their Friday episode anymore, and you're holding it ransom for £1.99 a month. That's not a great look, and it's also not a great service. One of the things that we always say internally is, if you're going to take subs seriously, you have to offer more for more, not less for more. And you have to think about what a premium experience really means. So, for example, if you did have 5 episodes a week that were an interview format, what is slightly more added value on top of that? One of the things we've started doing in line with our subs strategy over the last 3 years is include more editorial-led series. So we're actually nominated today for an award this evening for the Tiger Tamer series that Dave Musgrove led, which is an excellent series, which I recommend you listen to. That is a more intense, could be a 4-part, 5-part series that is more narrative-driven, there's more music, there's more sound effects. It's probably more akin to a radio program in some ways than it is a podcast, though I know those two should never be confused. So we've experimented with this quite a bit over the last 3 years, and the more you do to give users added value and the more you do to signpost that, the more typically you will see conversions start to play a part. So, at start we just did ad-free and the occasional bonus episode. We didn't want to make users feel like we were changing up on them too much. But then as we started to lean into it and do bonus content, as we started to do bespoke feeds, so you could have, a Georgian curated channel, you could have a Vikings, a Romans, whatever, we started to see people start to lean in more. And typically the metric that you hear about industry-wide is that, whatever your overall size of your actual free listening audience is, you can typically expect 4 to 5% conversion rate after, say, 6 months to a year. I think it's probably undercooked. I think you could probably go further than that, 7 or 8%, but you do have to offer a heck of a lot more. If you're willing to do weekly bonus episodes that are only for subs, if you're willing to do live event inclusions, if you're willing to build a community, then you could push it to maybe 7 or 8%. But that is a heavy commitment, and you have to have enough skill in your original audience size to justify that, and you have to charge a high enough price point to mean that the cost per user on your subs business is greater than your cost per user on your ad-funded business. So it becomes quite complicated to comb through that data and figure out where you're at.
So there we have it. We've talked a lot today about the shared ground between newsletters and podcasts, but there's one key difference, and we touched on it just a second ago, that's data and ownership. Podcast metrics are vague at the best of times, while newsletter platforms offer detailed analytics. It's one of the reasons why we see such innovation on platforms like Substack, where both solo entrepreneurs and local new startups are blossoming in the US as well as the UK, but also because they have the assurance that they own their email lists.
This isn't true of every platform, though. This is a big bugbear of mine. LinkedIn has in recent times started a newsletter feature, which is, it will serve people very, very well. But it retains ownership of the subscription lists, and it doesn't offer great analytics, and they're pitching it as a newsletter even though you get nobody's emails. So podcasting's got a lot of catching up to do to that, though. But I think in general, it would be fair to summarise that newsletters and podcasts have a lot of common strengths.
Yeah, we've talked about a lot of those, but let's just sum that up. They're great for going direct to audiences, showing off your best talent, creating superfans, and serving niches. Those four aspects address head-on the shared challenge of discoverability and getting picked up by audiences. I think that covers it, but if we missed anything, feel free to let us know. Where can we find you, Esther?
For the next 4 weeks, you actually can't find us. Media Voices is going on a break for August, proper European style. But if you want to get that relaunch newsletter I was talking about earlier straight into your inbox, we'll be focusing on podcasts, apps, newsletters, magazines, all the publisher products. You can go to voices.media to sign up and make sure you're following the Media Voices podcast on your podcast app of choice. If the Publisher Podcast and Newsletter Summit appeals to you, you can actually get all the sessions on demand. If you go to voices.media, there'll be a little tab where you can actually buy access to all the streams on YouTube.
So this is a really good chance for me to say once and for all on the record, Esther, thank you for every time that you've served up one of our pieces of news content in your newsletter. Essential reading for me. I encourage everyone to give that a read. Journalism.co.uk is completely as it sounds. Just type that into your internet browser of choice and you will find us. We're on all your usual podcast platforms as well. But I think that's all from us. Thanks for tuning in. And we'll catch you next time.
See you next time.